Well, welcome back, everybody. And thanks for a lively discussion this morning and very good considerations and input to us as we move ahead on our standard setting projects and consider other projects that a number of you mentioned that we should think about for our standard setting agenda. So I appreciated all the input during that session. Moving from planned standard setting to adopted standards, we mentioned a couple of times this morning the adoption of the 8 standards that we call the suite of risk assessment standards that are very foundational in their presentation. We think these standards are important. We should have improvements to audit quality, but we thought it would be a good idea to make sure the SAG understood these 8 standards and how we thought they came together and made those kind of improvements. So I think Dan, you have a couple of comments first to introduce this topic, and then Keith Wilson will lead the discussion.
Thanks, Marty. As Marty just mentioned and has come up a couple of times already today, on August 5th, the board adopted 8 new auditing standards related to the auditor's assessment of and response to risk. These standards deal with some basic foundational concepts, and their adoption was an important milestone for the board. While the risk assessment standards were being developed, they were the subject of discussion with the SAG at several of these meetings. We thought it would be worthwhile to spend a few minutes with the SAG today, giving you an overview of the final standards and how they're intended to operate. The predicate on which these standards are based is that identifying the risks of material misstatement and planning and performing the audit in a manner that properly addresses those risks is essential to affording investors reasonable assurance that the financial statements that they rely on are free of material error. Assessing and responding to risk is at the core of what auditors do. In addition, the new standards specifically emphasize the auditor's responsibility to consider the risk of fraud throughout the audit. The standards also contain new requirements intended to improve an auditor's evaluation of disclosures in financial statements. Of course, most firms' audit processes already incorporate risk-based methodologies, and the changes to audit manuals and staff training needed to implement these new standards should not be overwhelming. Along those same lines, I would note that while I think these standards will provide a better foundation for quality auditing, they should not, at least in most cases, have a significant impact on audit cost. Nonetheless, implementation is something that we need to stay on top of. One of the board's unique strengths as a standard setter is that we have the ability to inspect and see firsthand how our standards are being implemented. I hope we'll take advantage of that tool with respect to the risk assessment suite of standards. With that brief introduction of the topic, I want to turn the floor over to Keith Wilson, who's going to discuss the risk assessment standards in more detail and explain some of the enhancements that will result from their adoption. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. As Dan mentioned, I'm going to be talking about the significant enhancements in the risk assessment standards and also at the end make some observations to try and tie in what we've accomplished with the risk assessment standards and how it would affect future standard setting. Just by way of background, I think it's important to start off by pointing out that these risk assessment standards, these suite of 8 standards, if you will, cover the entire audit process. So they start with a very early preliminary engagement procedures and go all the way through the process of evaluating audit evidence to form the opinions to be presented in the auditor's report. So they do encompass the entire audit process. An important part of what we tried to accomplish with this project was to try and address both the unique aspects of the integrated audit, and as you may recall, the AS5, the process there is very much a risk-based process. So these standards needed to coordinate and align very well with the risk assessment standards, with the standard for the audit of internal control, while at the same time providing flexibility so that they could be appropriately applied for audits of non-accelerated filers and others that are not subject to the requirement to have an internal control audit. And these standards would be effective for audits of fiscal years beginning on or after December 15, 2010, so calendar 2011 audits, if you will, subject to the approval of the SEC. These standards, after the board had approved them, they've been filed with the commission. The commission, as part of its due process, has published them for comment in the Federal Register, and I believe comments are due to the SEC on those standards on October 18th. Brian, do you have anything else you want to add?
No, I think you got it right. The comment period does close next Monday, October 18th, and certainly to the extent that anyone does have input, would encourage submission of comment letters. The staff intends to promptly analyze the comment letters that come in and make any recommendation subsequent to that to the commission with respect to consideration of final approval, but certainly encourage any comments that people have before or before the end of the comment period here on October 18th.
Thanks, Brian. These standards are intended to protect investors by enhancing auditors' assessment of and response to risk in their audits. As Dan mentioned, most auditors today employ risk-based audit methodology, so it was critical that these standards would establish requirements that would promote effective risk-based audits. And in doing that, there are three primary ingredients for that. One is establishing a process for obtaining evidence to support the auditor's risk assessments, and strengthening the requirements for linking those risk assessments to the actual audit procedures that are performed and testing controls in the financial statements, and also promoting a more comprehensive evaluation of the evidence obtained during the audit. And we'll touch on each one of these points during the course of talking about the individual standards. Another point, as was mentioned, was to try and integrate the auditor's consideration of fraud, that is, the auditor's procedures for assessing and responding to fraud risk and evaluating the results of audit procedures and taking into account indications of fraud as part of the core audit process. This was in response to some observations from inspections that auditors at time had taken an isolated mechanical approach to their consideration of fraud. And it was important to emphasize through these standards that the auditor's consideration of fraud is very much integral part of the audit process. And the other thing that Dan mentioned was these standards also do focus more attention on financial statement disclosures, and particularly in light of the increasing importance of disclosures to financial reporting. Other areas where there were enhancements, there were in the planning standard and the materiality standard, there are additional requirements related to multi-location engagements, which are particularly important considering that many of the largest corporations, in fact, all of the largest corporations are multinational corporations, multi-location corporations. So we felt like more attention was needed in our standards on these points. The standards also describe more directly the supervisory responsibilities of the engagement partner based upon, among other things, the risk of material misstatement. And the standards also enhance the requirements regarding what it means to obtain sufficient appropriate evidence to support the auditor's opinion. And we'll talk about each of these points in the context of walking through the individual standards. Auditing Standard 8 really starts at the beginning by articulating what the components of audit risk are, and then tees up, if you will, the sources of information, evidence that the auditor draws upon to, for example, identify and evaluate and assess the risks of material misstatement and to develop appropriate substantive procedures to reduce detection risk to an appropriately low level. The audit planning standard is a significant update of the auditor's responsibilities in planning. There were a couple of areas that I wanted to point out that are especially worth mentioning in this area. One, again, is the multi-location engagements. There was very little in our old interim standards about how you go through the process of selecting locations to test and how much work you would give to the in those locations that are selected for testing. This standard aligns with AS5, but more importantly, has a much more extensive discussion of what the auditor's responsibilities are for looking at the risks associated with various locations determining the amount of work that needs to be tailored to address the risks in the individual locations. Another area that was particularly important and an area that we think is improvement is in the area of using or considering in the planning process whether it's necessary to use persons with specialized skill or knowledge. And the idea there is the auditor is supposed to make a determination in planning whether they need a person or specialized skill or knowledge to effectively conduct the audit. The old interim standards, this consideration was narrowed to only IT specialty. And these requirements are much broader. They would encompass anything that one might be considered a specialty area. Maybe it's a specialty area of accounting. Certainly IT is still considered in there. Forensic services, even appraisers, actuaries, anything that might be considered a special skill or knowledge. The idea is to think about whether those persons are needed to complete the audit. And then if a specialist, if you will, is going to be used, the auditor still is required to have enough knowledge of the subject matter to be able to communicate the objectives of the specialist work, to be able to understand where the specialist has in fact met those objectives, and to evaluate how that specialist work affects the relationship to the auditor's other procedures and the auditor's report. So this would, effectively require the auditor to be engaged with the other audit, with the specialist, and not just outsource, if you will, that specialist area. Auditing Standard 10, as I mentioned before, doesn't necessarily create new requirements for supervision, but what it does is update the requirements and explain them in a much more direct way than they have been in our old interim standards. That is, it specifically states that the engagement partner is responsible for the engagement and its performance. It's the engagement partner is responsible for the supervision of the work of engagement team members, and then the standard specifically lays out the necessary nature and extent of supervisory activities. And these activities would apply to also persons that assist the engagement partner in supervision. One of those key principles that's highlighted on the slide there is that the extent of supervision should be commensurate with the risk of material misstatement. So the higher risk areas would be required to have more attention. Auditing standard number 11 replaces the old interim standard that this standard replaces talked about materiality much more from an auditor-centric perspective, the auditor making judgments about materiality. And this standard begins with the concept of materiality that applies under the federal securities laws, which is much more of a reasonable investor perspective. So it requires the auditor, as the old standard did, to establish an appropriate materiality level, but it does articulate it in the concept of thinking about what would be the level of misstatement that would affect the judgment of a reasonable investor. Similarly, there's a requirement to establish lower materiality levels when there are accounts and disclosures where misstatements of lesser amounts are likely to influence the judgment of a reasonable investor. For example, if there are particular accounts or disclosures that are particularly important to investors, then those would be, it could be that those misstatements would, a lower level of misstatement would be important to investors. So in that case, it would require the auditor to lower their materiality level for those accounts. And another thing that's important, another important requirement in this standard is to reevaluate the materiality levels when necessary, when there are changes in circumstances or additional information comes to the auditor's attention that would indicate that a lower level of materiality, if you will, is appropriate. And in that case, the auditor would need to go back and revisit their work and determine what they would need to do to modify their audit procedures to in light of the lower materiality level. AS 12 is the first standard that in the previous slide I had on enhancements. This really is about the process of what the auditor needs to do to identify and assess the risks of material misstatement. It requires the auditor to do work to support their risk, to attain sufficient evidence to support their risk assessments. And it establishes a process that prompts the auditor to connect the dots, if you will, or do the homework necessary, if you will, to identify and appropriately analyze the risks of error or fraud in the financial statements. The standard is designed to be scalable based on the size and complexity of the company, so a larger, more complex company is going to require more effort, more attention, more work in terms to meet the overall objective of the standard of having sufficient evidence to support the risk assessments. These procedures do include specifically procedures for identifying and assessing fraud risks, but perhaps as importantly, during this entire process, the auditor is supposed to be looking at risk, taking all this information into account, and thinking about how what errors or fraud could result from these from the circumstances that that are presented in, with that company. And the standard does include new requirements about forming expectations during the course of understanding the company's selection and implementation of accounting principles. The auditor is required to form some expectations about the disclosures that would be necessary for the financial statements. And during the course of the risk assessment process, there are various requirements related to considering the risks of omitted, incomplete, or inaccurate disclosures. This slide presents to you the categories of risk assessment procedures. Again, this is intended to be a much more holistic process than was presented under the old interim standards, which tended to be much more around your basic nuts and bolts bookkeeping and accounting. This is much more focused around looking at the company, the environment that it operates, the industry, and other matters that could affect the risks of misstatement. And again, designed to highlight for the auditor, to prompt the auditor to think about different ways that things can go wrong with the financial statements. For example, there are a couple of requirements related to looking at executive compensation and whether or not there may be incentives or pressures from executive compensation arrangements that might present risks of material misstatement of the financial statement. So there's a rather comprehensive process that the auditor is required to go through to understand the types of things that can go wrong with the financial statements. And coming out of this, there are really three outputs to the risk assessment process. One of them is just simply once they've identified the risk, an assessment of the risk, what's the likelihood, magnitude of misstatements related to the risk, then there are a couple of other pieces to it that really then set the stage for the linkage that we'll talk about. The identification of significant accounts and disclosures and their relevant assertions. These concepts have been around in PCAOB standards for a while. They were originally defined in AS5, and they essentially boil down to looking at whether there's a reasonable possibility of misstatement in the accounts and disclosures and assertions that could result, that would result in material misstatement of the financial statements. And then the companion to that is significant risks, which are risks that require special audit consideration. And they do, by definition, include fraud risks. So the auditor goes through this process, assesses the risks, and then identifies these significant accounts and disclosures and significant risks. That sets the stage for auditing standard number 13, which is where they really apply that and are required to link in those risk assessments to the actual conduct of their audit. And they're required to respond to the risk of material misstatement through overall responses, which get into, which are things such as the staffing and scheduling, incorporating an element of unpredictability, those kinds of responses, which under our old interim standards were just restricted to fraud risk. They're now holistically designed to apply to all the risks of material misstatement. And then there are responses involving the nature, timing, and extent of audit procedures. Here we're talking about tests of controls and the substantive procedures of tests of accounts. The auditor's required to perform procedures that address each of the risks of material misstatement that they've identified, and they're specifically required to perform substantive tests for each relevant assertion of each significant account and disclosure. And for the larger companies that have the ICFR audit, in that area, you may recall the auditor's required to perform tests of controls for relevant assertions. So you see this process has aligned the testing of the testing for the financial statement audit with the audit of internal control. In the area of tests of controls, it's important to note that the requirements around tests of controls for the financial statement audit are designed, again, to align with AS5 so that in the respect that if there's a similar concept like the nature of tests of controls, timing of tests of controls, those concepts use the same language. So it's easy to understand the relationship among the two. But I also point out that for audits of only financial statements, non-accelerated filers, for example, they still have the same flexibility that they did before in determining when to test controls. So essentially, in most cases, they would perform tests of controls only in those situations where they intend to rely on controls. If there are fraud risks or other significant risks, the auditor is required to perform audit procedures that are specifically responsive to the risks. So they would need to have procedures that are specifically mapped to those risks, and they would also need to perform tests of details in response to, as part of their response to those risks. So they wouldn't be able to just perform tests of controls, analytical procedures in those cases. They would need to actually, if you will, get their hands dirty and actually perform some detailed testing in those areas. In terms of evaluating audit results, this standard is intended to provide, as I mentioned before, a comprehensive evaluation of the audit evidence that's obtained, both positive evidence and negative evidence. And the process was brought together this way partially in light of observations that auditors at times had not always evaluated all the evidence before them, especially when they found contrary evidence. So this standard requires the auditor to look at all the evidence that they've obtained, to evaluate the results of that evidence, and also to step back and form a specific conclusion about whether or not they've obtained enough evidence to support their opinion. And the standard has a process that, again, walks the auditor through an evaluation of all the relevant aspects of their audit evidence, including uncorrected misstatements and conditions identified during the audit that would relate to their assessment of fraud risk. So there are a number of things that they put together. Some of these are not entirely new, although many of this discussion has been updated. I think it's important to note that when we're talking about aiming for a comprehensive evaluation of the evidence, that under the old interim standards, one would have had to look to flip through five different auditing standards to find this kind of to find analogous requirements. So there's a certain amount of pulling this together and also updating and improving the requirements in this area. Some examples of newer enhanced requirements on this standard, there are the old requirements around evaluating misstatements and estimates were somewhat generalized. The updated requirement specifically directs the auditor to look at accounting estimates and evaluate it in two respects. One is, does it comply with the accounting standard? Second of all, is it reasonable? And if it's outside that very reasonableness, then it's considered a misstatement. There's also a much more discussion in the standard about evaluating potential management bias in the financial statements. And there are some specific additional procedures for situations where the auditor identifies a misstatement and management identifies an offsetting adjustment. The auditor is specifically required to go on to perform procedures to understand why this new offsetting adjustment wasn't identified previously, and also to consider the implications of that situation on their views of management integrity and fraud risk. The audit evidence standard establishes the requirement that the auditor needs to design and perform audit procedures to obtain sufficient appropriate audit evidence. Also importantly, when we're talking about in the risk assessment area, obtaining sufficient evidence to support the auditor's risk assessments, in the response area to performing work to obtain sufficient appropriate evidence to addressing the risks, this standard really outlines what it means, what sufficiency means, what appropriateness means, how to evaluate the relevance and reliability of audit evidence. So this is a key, the standard here provides key principles that underline the other standards in the suite. And it also has a section on that discusses the auditor's responsibility for selecting items for testing. This standard, because these standards were so foundational, there were many amendments to the standards, a fairly lengthy list. Some of them are, the lion's share of them are actually just technical amendments, but there are a few amendments that standards that were amended that I would like to highlight that I think are important. One is auditing standard 3 was amended to explicitly require the auditor to document a summary of the identified risk and the assessment of those risks and the responses, including how the responses link to the risk assessments. And we think that will be very useful for auditors within that are performing supervision and review. They're important for the engagement quality reviewer and determining that they've actually addressed all the risks that they've identified. The substantive analytical procedures, AU329 has been amended to essentially focus only on substantive analytical procedures in light of some observations that auditors have had challenges with performing analytical procedures that meet the requirements of our standard. We have a standard now that focuses solely on what you need to do when you're performing analytical procedures as a test of an account or disclosure. The audit sampling standard has been amended to enhance the requirements around determining sample sizes and non-statistical samples. And AU336 and AU543, essentially they were amended. The primary amendments there are to help explain to the auditor when they need to look to those standards and when they need to look to auditing standard number 10. As was mentioned in the earlier session, we currently have standard setting projects that will likely result in replacing, if not substantially amending, both AU336 and 543. And lastly, AU316, although many requirements have been integrated from AU316 into the suite of eight risk assessment standards, it's important to note that the that standard continues to have a lot of important information in it. It now has a roadmap that explains how the auditor's consideration of fraud is accomplished throughout the audit process, and it continues to have a lot of important requirements around the auditor's responses to management override, including testing of journal entries, looking at management tests for management bias related to accounting estimates, and those kinds of matters. And finally, looking, I guess, to today and to the future in terms of standard setting process, I think it's easier to think of these standards, although they outline the essentials of the audit process, they also serve as a framework for any standard setting that we do that relates to audit planning procedures, procedures around assessing risk, procedures around performing audit procedures in response to risk. All of those core elements are there in place and can be built on. So, for example, we have a confirmation standard. It can look to confirmation is a procedure that's performed in response to risk. So it can build on those principles in the risk assessment standards and talk about things that where one might use confirmation in response to significant risk, for example. Also, there are we've mentioned things around use of specialists that could be helpful to the specialists project, and also as they think about the auditor engaging or employing a specialist and them being supervised and what additional they can focus on, what additional requirements may be necessary for proper supervision of a specialist. And another example of the principal auditor project, I think, will be able to leverage some of the work that's already been done around multi-location scoping. So I think these standards will be able to be leveraged, and we would look to leverage them in any situation where we're talking about standards setting around audit procedures. And that concludes my remarks. So thank you.
Mary Hartman Mars.
Oh, thank you for that, Keith. I did have a quick question. On AS number 3, on audit documentation, and as you went through it, I think this is a really robust information that can be provided. But I was wondering, is it considered that this is going to be auditor communication to the audit committee? And then, are they going to be able to provide that kind of information to the audit committee? And then, of course, from the investor's perspective, I know there's a lot of questions about that, but it would be nice to know if there's something that might be in even summary format that would go to investors as well.
Well, the amendments to AS3 obviously only relate to audit documentation. Certainly, if there are matters in there that are considered important, they can be thought about and incorporated into the project on communications with the audit committee. So there's an opportunity to do that, and I know we've had discussions during the course of the development of that proposed standard about trying to make sure we were talking about similar concepts using similar language and that sort of thing. So certainly there's an opportunity to do that.
Galen Hanson.
Yes, thanks a lot, Keith. I really appreciate it. I do have a question on Standard 13. And it has to do with this notion of assessing control risk below the maximum, which has been a concept that's been out there for some time. I thought the Auditing Standards Board, when they updated their risk assessment suite, to call it that, got rid of that that notion and sort of forced the issue with practitioners where that wasn't an out. You couldn't just say that you had assessed controls at maximum. Really, what does that mean? And I don't know if that is still in the standard or was just in the preparation of this slide, but I thought we were trying to basically give firms no other choice other than they've got to understand the environment, they have to understand the controls, and then make their assessment. Am I wrong about that?
The standards would actually, they may not have exactly the same language that you're describing, but the effect is the same. The auditor is still going to be required to, as part of the risk assessment process, to understand the internal control over financial reporting, including evaluating the design. If there are significant risks, they have to specifically understand the controls that are in place to address those significant risks and to evaluate design related to that. The point that I was referring to was essentially saying that if the auditor wants to rely on controls to assess control risk below maximum, then they would need to test the design and operating effectiveness of those controls. So it's more that you can't rely on controls if you don't test them. That's essentially the point.
Gary Kaybrook.
Thank you, Marty. And let me begin by just complimenting the entire organization. I thought this is a really well-written, integrated set of new standards. Even if a lot of it's pulling together old stuff, it was time for a good refresh. And it really is a good work product. But the Keith, and I suppose the answer has to be based on the feedback you receive from the auditing firms. But in what way, if any, do you expect any consequential changes in audits going forward? Again, assuming a reasonably well-executed audit against the current standards, are you expecting to see any important changes that are sort of pervasive and broad-based? And again, if the auditing firms want to respond as opposed to you, I'll be willing to hear whoever has to say what about it. Thanks.
Well, certainly a number of the improvements in the standards could be described as things that good auditors do now. Okay, so things where we use the example of evaluating executive compensation and seeing if there are risks posed by that. Certainly, that's something that some auditors are doing now. And a number of other things would be things that some auditors are doing now, and to some extent. I mean, there is an extent to which what we've done is updated and improved the standards related to so that these are now requirements and not just best practices beyond the standards. I suppose that some of this is going to bear out depending upon what individual firm methodologies require. I would hope that if there wasn't already, there'd be a much more integrated and robust consideration of fraud, for example. I hope that this will also help, in some cases, firms better integrate their audit, when they're performing integrated audits, integrate their audit of internal control with their audit of financial statements, and hopefully position them to more effectively link their responses to the risks that they identify. Those are some examples, and hopefully perhaps at least apply more diligence in the evaluation of the audit process. So.
And we think the standards help auditors go through the audit process in a much more logical, disciplined fashion. By the structure in which these standards are designed and the process through which they take the auditor. So we think that hopefully that's an improvement, just the process by which the organization of these take place.
I'm sorry.
Paul Sobel?
This question may just show how uninformed I am, but it's kind of a philosophical question. I was reminded back in your discussion on standard number 11 about this reasonable investor perspective concept, and you know, it got me thinking, as I have in the past, you know, doesn't that kind of require, for example, you know, Wayne to get into Mary's mind and say, what would she consider to be material, and does Mary represent the other, you know, current investors and potential future investors? And, you know, maybe, you know, it says, you know, as applied under the current federal security laws, maybe there's enough guidance for that, but I was wondering, maybe this is a question for the firms, you know, how do you make that judgment? Is there research that has shown here's typically what investors think about materiality? Are they more or less risk-averse than the auditors? Has there been enough cases that we've been able to glean that information, or am I just getting way too esoteric with this question?
The question does come up from time to time. I think the way that I would I think this is, well, first of all, in a sense, this is not new. This is the standard auditors have been held to. It just hasn't been recognized in the auditing standards as well. I think part of the, I mean, there is sort of a technical way to think about this, but there, I think more importantly, this hopefully will prompt auditors to have the right mindset. In some cases, you might see situations where an auditor might have a certain approach to materiality that might help get their sample sizes to where they want them to be, but have a hard time rationalizing how that approach to considering materiality has any relationship to something that would be important to an investor when they're looking at the financial statement. So hopefully that will have it will create more of a investor perspective mindset on the auditor in that sense.
I'll add to that just a little bit. I think, as Keith said, it's not new, that's first of all, but it is newly articulated right in the standard here. And hopefully it really does prompt the auditor by being in the standard. If the auditor concludes, well, this is a 3% difference in net income and that's not material in the auditor's view, well, that's not the important factor. The only important factor, the factor is, would that be important to a reasonable investor to make sure that that conclusion is reached based upon what would a reasonable investor think about that difference? How did that investor think about that difference in a trend or whatever it might be? So it's been in the law, but I think it prompts someone to make that right decision regarding either a quantitative disclosure or a quantitative amount or a qualitative situation in terms of, yeah, that's one omitted compliance disclosure. Yeah, but is it one on which a reasonable investor would find that to be very important, that fact, had he or she known it in the total mix of things? So, again, is it radical? No. But it's intended to reinforce the concepts right in the standards of what materiality is in accordance with federal securities laws. Who's next? Lynn Turner.
Marty, I got a question on the slide on auditing standard number 14. And it comes up in the context of also the report that the board issued with respect to its inspections of audits. And there's been some writings on this. And the issue is, in determining whether there's sufficient appropriate audit evidence to have been obtained, do you interpret this standard to say that the auditor needs to look not only for evidence that would corroborate the assumptions or the numbers or the methodology that management has put forward, or would you interpret this to say that the auditor also needs to seek out, if it exists, and consider contrary information when such contrary information does exist out there? It seems that your inspection report seems to say that the auditor would need to consider both, that they couldn't just look to corroborating information. But is that how you would interpret this standard now, that the auditor has to look for both? They can't just be blinded and look for one in absence of the other?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. The auditors needs to consider, they need to perform appropriate procedures to respond to the risk. They get evidence that points in the other direction that says the number may not be correct, and that evidence has to be considered. It's specifically required in the standard.
But does the auditor need to look for that information? Obviously, and in part this goes to the question that Gary just raised, because I think it's a good question. In the past, and according to your inspection reports, auditors were just seeking out corroborating information. Does this say that the auditor can't just take what management has given in the form of corroborating information, but they also have to seek out if there's contrary information reasonably available out there, that they should be aware of that and look to that as well? Or is it only if someone all of a sudden drops it on their doorsteps that they got to consider it?
Well, I don't think it's the latter. I think that the auditor has to, the requirement essentially is to obtain relevant and reliable evidence. So that's going to be from whatever the best sources of information are. It's a little bit difficult to say categorically they have to go out and search for something that who knows what it is, then just for the purpose of trying to find something that's different, but that's contrary. But I guess the principal point is you can't just take management's word for it. You cannot just take an assertion without actually looking for it and looking for evidence that's objective and reliable.
Comment on that,
Marty.
Too, and maybe an example of auditing the allowance for loan losses. If management's made an assertion that the allowance for loan losses is reduced because they believe that economic conditions in a certain area this year improved, and they expect, therefore, that there's fewer job losses, et cetera, than they initially thought, I think the auditor has a responsibility. I believe the auditor has a responsibility under this standard to understand that assertion management made, and also whether the facts support that, and whether there is evidence about the economic conditions that would indicate, no, job losses are increasing and not decreasing. And so not to simply accept the look for corroborative evidence that the conditions improved, but look also to see if there's evidence that conditions haven't improved. So I believe the answer to your question is yes.
Yeah, I think the other part that's important to bring out here is, again, even stepping back to AS-12 and doing your homework to be able to understand the environment, the company well enough to be able to recognize those situations that might not quite ring true, and to understand where there may be contrary evidence that would call into question management's assertion.
You also mentioned that the standard requires the auditor to, consider the risk of fraud and hopefully become a more robust consideration than we had in the past. And surveys and evidence indicates that the number one way we find fraud is through whistleblower hotlines and or that it's done through period-end audit adjustments. To what extent would you interpret that this then requires the auditor to take a look at that whistleblower hotline and how it's working and whether it brings fraud to one's attention? And also, to what extent then does this risk assessment require the auditor to take a look at those year-end or period-end adjustments?
Well, let me take them in reverse order. There's specific requirements around looking at and testing the period-end close process and looking at the adjustments that are made in the financial statements and reconciling back from the financial statements to the underlying accounting records. So I think there's pretty robust testing in that area. There's also, during the part of the risk assessment, one of the risk assessment procedures is getting an understanding of how that whistleblower process is working and what information is coming out of that whistleblower process. So it is part of the, it's in within the scope of the risk assessment procedures.
Is the whistleblower specifically discussed at all in the standard?
In auditing standard 12, it's part of when the auditor's trying to, it's in part of the process making inquiries to understand what kinds of information that they may have, may have come to light from the whistleblower process.
Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. Just to follow up on Gary's earlier question, there's certainly been some anecdotal evidence over the years that both management and auditors, let's say, care in looking at the numbers in financial statement footnotes is a little bit different than the care and effort put into numbers that are in the face of financial statements. I guess one example in recent history has been stock option expenses, where they were disclosed in the footnotes for many, many years, and then when it was finally required to be put in the income statement, we found that in many cases the footnote disclosures had not been complied with by many companies for many years. So my question is follow-up to Gary's question. Is there something in here that you expect will create any kind of significant change in practice in how audit practices are with respect to footnote disclosures?
Well, as I mentioned before, disclosures was an important consideration when we were looking at the formulating the requirements and the risk assessment standards. We do have sort of on the front end and the back end requirements to, first of all, form some expectations about what the required procedures ought to be. And during the risk assessment process, at various points, to consider the risks of omitted, incomplete, or inaccurate disclosure. So that's a specifically identified risk area that the auditor has to look at. And then where there are risks, they're required to respond to that. And then at the end, as part of evaluating, one of the things you evaluate as part of evaluating audit results is evaluating the presentation of the financial statements and whether the financial statements include the information that is essential for the fair presentation of the financial statements. So, again, there's the look back on the end and the conclusion on the end about looking at whether the financial statements include the necessary disclosure. So there's a lot more emphasis, and it's baked into a core part of the process and the standards. So I would expect that should at least raise awareness and hopefully will provide more diligence and attention to that particular area.
Gail Hansen.
Thank you. In the Form 10-K, management is required to have certain risk disclosures, and I was wondering how these risk assessment standards coordinate with management's own disclosures of their risk.
Well, that would be certainly an input into the process, that something that the auditor would look at and understand management's process for identifying risk and responding to risk. That's a specific part of their risk assessment process. So it's one of the things that the auditor is required to look at, and should be informed by that when they're doing their own risk assessments and responding to those.
Wayne Collins.
Yeah, I just want to go back to the issue that Lynn had raised before, talking about the looking for contrary evidence. Seemed that whole discussion could be wrapped around the concept, the fundamental concept of auditor skepticism. So based on the auditor's understanding of the business, looking at what evidence he or she needs to corroborate an assertion, continuously asking the question, does that make sense based on what I know about the business? So I would think that they looking for contrary evidence would be taken up by adopting an appropriate professional skeptical attitude.
Right, and to underscore that point, there are multiple places in the standards that point out the importance of professional skepticism. In the brainstorming session, it required an AS-12 as part of the auditor's response in AS-13. And specifically, there's discussion in the standard about not taking management's responses at face value and obtaining corroboration and reassessing your risk assessments if you're investigating further if management's giving you answers that don't seem to they seem vague or unresponsive or raise concern. So it is multiple points in the standard addressed.
Thanks, Wayne. That's a good point. Neary Buxman?
One of the slides pointed to connecting the dots, so what I'd like to do is also try to connect some of the dots as well. I'll start with echoing Jeff's comment about disclosures and also connecting it to comments that, Marty, you made earlier as far as challenges in auditing fair value, and given that some of those fair value has been previously audited in the notes, one would say that those challenges should be commensurate with what have been experienced all along if, in fact, the same auditing procedures have been applied, give or take, you know, a couple degrees of freedom because it's been somewhat more challenging environment in the recent past. But more broadly, in the context of connecting the dots and risk assessment, I would think, and the comment was made, what necessary disclosures are. I would think that the disclosures could be used in two purposes, right? One is you go into the financial statement, look at you audit the numbers, then you look at the footnotes, and you audit the footnotes. But if you do your risk assessment, you actually can reverse the order. You can actually look at the footnotes and say, do the footnotes telling me the story that will allow me to understand whether the numbers are correct? So there could be some element of joining the interaction or the audit interaction in a more holistic or harmonized process between the footnotes and the audits, and also the comment made earlier about the reasonable investor could also be connected. Stated differently, it's not the necessary disclosure, but if I'm a reasonable investor and I read the disclosure, I can develop expectations about the number. If I look at the number, I can understand from the disclosure what the numbers are telling me. So some mindset about necessary disclosure can actually detract from the mission that you're trying to achieve with providing the disclosure. So just, it's a nuance, but I think this is some of the sound bites that you get just by reading it and just by listening to the discussion.